Why, I hear bay waters lapping with low sounds by the shore. And that can only mean one thing. Cousin Rick is calling from Needham, Massachusetts with Rick's Tech Talk. Good morning, Cousin Rick.
Good morning, RT.
All right, we got it together finally.
Yes. Yeah, I heard the bay waters lapping there at McCovey Cove in the San Francisco Bay. I guess you're getting ready for opening day.
Getting ready, yeah. I got my mitt all oiled up and ready to go.
With your knees foot oil?
Yeah, right, the knees foot oil, yes.
Yes. Oh, I forgot about oiling my glove there. That's okay. So how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. And don't ask me how the weather is. It's just a gray, dull day here with the wind blowing. It's in the 40s, but it feels a lot colder than that. Yeah. So let's move on here.
Okay. Well, how about the ride of the week?
Oh, the ride of the week. Okay, this week, the ride of the week is the 2024 Mazda 3 Premium Plus Edition. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a very stylish-looking car. It's a small car. The EPA says it's a mid-size car, but it's really a small car. But when you give it the wife test, she goes, wow, this is stylish, and it was comfortable, too. So that's an outstanding feature there. It's got the 2.5-liter turbocharged engine, and it has a 6-speed automatic transmission. The engine puts out 227 horsepower and 310 pound-feet of torque. That combination gives you EPA numbers of 23 miles per gallon city, 31 highway, for a combined number of 26, which to me is not all that good, considering the car is a small car. Mm. And I remember, if you may remember, last week's car, the Subaru Impreza, it's another small car, got similar mileage, which really wasn't that good for a small vehicle. I think maybe the Mazda 3, because it only has a 6-speed automatic transmission, that probably keeps the mileage numbers down. But as far as government safety ratings go, the overall vehicle score hasn't been compiled yet. But for the tests they have done in frontal crash and rollover, the Mazda 3 earns 5 stars, the best rating you can get from the National Institute of Highway and Traffic Safety. Mm-hmm. So that's a plus there. Some of the other features here, this is the Premium Plus Edition, so you have some extra features built in. You have a heated steering wheel, paddle shifters to give like the feel of a manual transmission, adaptive front lighting, which moves the headlights to go around corners at night, a windshield wiper de-icer, which is handy, and I'll get into that in the winter here. Mm-hmm. It's got a snowflake white pearl paint, striking color, and it has the premium package includes the Mazda navigation system. There's also an active driving display, which is better known to us as a head-up display, mm-hmm. and a Bose premium sound system with 12 speakers. Now, the manufacturer's suggested retail price is $36,650, and the Snowflake Pearl adds about $400 more, but everything else is standard on the Premium Plus Edition. For the total price, including delivery, total MSRP is $38,265. Mm-hmm. Which is about $9,000 more than the Subaru Impreza from last week, but there's a lot more features on this Mazda 3. Now, the active head-up display, which I really enjoy, someone who had the car before me had turned that off. I wasn't aware it was in the car until I read the sticker, which was after we drove it back home from New York in a hellacious rainstorm and ice event. We just missed it in New York. We came through it in the Berkshires out in Western Mass in Otis Beckett country. Mm-hmm. But it was, I would have appreciated the head-up display had I known it was there, because in that kind of weather, you don't have to take your eyes off the road. But it was a nice ride, got us through, and this week's ride of the week, the Mazda 3 Premium Plus Edition.
All right. That sounds good. Let's see. Anything else automotive today?
Yeah, that's... you know, one thing in Tech Talk, we like to have a lot of automotive items. Mm-hmm. But rather than a specific vehicle or technology, here's something I think we can all relate to automotive-wise, and that's potholes, especially in the winter. Now, I don't know in California where you are. Do you have many potholes?
Not nearly as many as you do.
Right. Yeah, you don't have the weather extremes that we do here in the Northeast. But... you know, when I lived in Pittsburgh, they used to call it the Pittsburgh Pothole Fiesta. But we have from the UK and England, the Liverpool School of Engineering has come up with a remote pothole repair system that they're prototyping now. And this is an interesting concept. Now, using vision systems and artificial intelligence, the idea is to put sensors and recorders on, say, buses, trash trucks, and urban municipal vehicles, maintenance vehicles, that when they drive over, say, a municipality's roads, they would scan the roads for potential damage and cracks that could lead to potholes. Now, this data would be sent back to a certain central location, and then they've come up with a prototype vehicle that goes out, say, you could do this at night when there's very little traffic on the road. You could go out, scan the road, find the cracks, and repair them so that they don't grow into potholes. Mm. And this is being prototyped in, if I can say it right, Hertfordshire, England. Mm-hmm. And the next step would be, if this works to prevent potholes, to come up with a larger vehicle that actually would repair potholes that end up growing in the changeable weather conditions. So an interesting concept there.
Yeah, you know, well, I wish them well, because we could use less potholes.
Right. Now, you know, whether you fix the potholes remotely or send a crew out, but the fact that you scan these continuously, say, on urban vehicles, you can maybe prevent the potholes from forming, which is, it's a lot cheaper to prevent tooth decay than to repair the cavities.
Right. Right.
To have an analogy.
Okay, well, what else do you have for us?
Okay, and I think this is something we talked about earlier in the week via email and so on. The first flight of the XB-1, which is a... Oh, is that the cow's cow?
Cows are clapping.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
Not the supersonic cow, but the XB-1 is a small subscale vehicle that'll pave the way for Boom Aerospace. I love the name of that company. Yep. I don't know if you'd want to name a company Boom for an airplane, but... yeah. Nonetheless, they've come up with this XB-1 demonstrator, which will fly supersonically eventually, and it will prove the aerodynamics for what's going to be a small supersonic airliner that can fly quietly across. The idea is to have a low sonic boom that would be allow it to fly over land, unlike the Concorde, which made a larger boom sound and was restricted from flying over land.
Mm-hmm.
So that made its first flight.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting first flight. They just flew for 12 minutes, flew around the airport, didn't retract the landing gear, and then landed. And what was interesting to me is that the horizontal stabilizer seemed to be very highly deflected to keep the nose up during the flight. Maybe that was more of a safety precaution.
Hmm. All right. Well, what else do you have for us today?
Okay. Well, speaking of flying, now we've talked about these EVTOLs, in other words, electric helicopters that are essentially looking like big drones or small airplanes electrically powered. And a survey was taken of potential passengers for these, that how would you feel about flying in an electric airplane that maybe is remotely piloted, that would essentially be a big drone? And surprisingly enough, people said, well, if it was a clear day and it wasn't too windy, they wouldn't mind flying in one of these things, although the consensus was that the public would want to see these things flying for a few months before they got in one.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting chicken and egg possibility there.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's see. Do you have anything else for today?
Well, let's see. We've got an interesting concept from a former member of a former principal in Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' aerospace company. And he has teamed up with Harrison Schmitt, you might remember, was the geologist on Apollo mission.
Yes.
And they've come up with a company called Interloon that's come out of the stealth mode after getting some funding. And their premise would be to send vehicles to the moon that would mine helium-3, which is an isotope of helium. And I heard Jack Schmitt speak many years ago. I think it was the 50th or the 40th anniversary of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always talking about a company called Interloon, which would mine helium-3 that they discovered during the Apollo missions. And this is such a rare isotope of helium that a few kilograms of this would be worth having an expedition go to the moon and start extracting this. The sun spits out all this helium, and so there's so much helium-3, which is a small isotope, a rare isotope of helium, that you can gather this and bring it back to Earth to be economical, even in such small quantities of just a few kilograms, to use for cooling in quantum computers and in fusion technology, eventually to have fusion power plants. So an interesting concept there. Good luck with that. And we'll see where that goes.
All right. Well, let's see. Are you close to wrapping up?
Okay, yeah. Well, let's wrap it up with just noting the passing of General Tom Stafford at the age of 93, a Gemini and Apollo astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
He flew in Gemini with Gene Cernan, then flew Apollo 10, which was the mission before the first moon landing, with Cernan and John Young. And he flew within 9 miles of the moon on that mission to prove out the rendezvous and all the technologies needed before the final moon landing, the first moon landing could take place.
Mm.
And then in the 70s, he flew the Apollo-Soyuz test project, which linked up with a Russian spacecraft piloted by Alexei Leonov, the first person, the first man to do a walk in space back in the early 60s.
Mm.
So rest in peace, Tom Stafford.
Yeah. That's some heavy, accomplishment.
That's right. I remember on Apollo 10, they were speculating, well, would he go the final 9 miles and actually land to do it quicker, to do it ahead of the first mission? But I think he was too much of a professional to do that.
Yeah.
And besides, I don't think they had enough fuel to do a full mission. And if something like that ever happened, the mission team wasn't ready to do that, and that would have been a surprise.
It would have been a big surprise for us.
Yes, and he would have lost his commission for sure. And then I can tell you an Alexei Leonov story. I actually met him. Yeah, I met him here in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
The first man to do a walk in space. He was going to be the Russian who landed on the moon if they ever had the successful moon rocket. And one time I was in New York, I'm in a Russian bookstore, and my limited knowledge of Russian, I see this book looking out at me. It says Leonov on the spine.
Mm-hmm.
So I pull it out, and I knew he was an artist too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a book of all his paintings,
mm-hmm.
along with Alexei Sokolov, another Russian space artist.
Right.
So I had this book, and in it is a picture of him doing the first walk in space that he painted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out he was coming to Boston to do a Soviet space exhibit at the time. And I met him there. I handed him the book, opened up to the page with his painting on it, and he gives me this big smile, and he signs the thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got this book with Alexei Leonov's autograph of his first walk in space.
A nice touch.
And that's a wrap.
That's
glad
a wrap.
We could get together.
Okay, that's great.
Be well, Bob.
Okay, take care. And that was Cousin Rick calling from Needham, Massachusetts, with Rick's Tech Talk, a regular feature of the Newtopian Dream.